Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The seven-day positive coronavirus test rate in Massachusetts now just over 3.7%, more than double what it was at the beginning of the month, and that is also the highest rate reported since the beginning of the year in January. Scientists predict the new, potentially more infectious variant of the coronavirus will inevitably show up in the U.S. too. Those numbers sound scary. Later in the hour, we're going to take your questions with two local physicians. But first, let's turn to someone who tries to make sense of COVID trends as they unfold and ask, what are we learning as this one does? Sam Scarpino is the managing director of pathogen surveillance at the Rockefeller Foundation's Pandemic Prevention Institute and an affiliate professor at Northeastern University. Sam, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, Sam, from what your modeling shows right now, are we standing on the edge of another surge, in another surge, at risk of another surge?
Well, certainly across much of the United States and, you know, New England, Massachusetts, Boston, no exception, we are well inside of a surge caused by the Delta variant. The hospitalization percentages are creeping up towards the high 90s. We're seeing case numbers, you know, continuing to remain high. And so very much in the middle of a serious situation with respect to COVID.
So you're saying we are currently in a Delta surge, correct?
That's right. And so the measures we would need to take to control that surge, masking, testing, tracing, working on ventilation, focusing on vaccination, these are the same things that we'd need to do in anticipation of the arrival of the Omicron variant.
So let's talk about that arrival. What questions do we need answers to in, say, the next 7 to 10 days in order to understand what's really going on with Omicron?
First, I would say we were very fortunate that individuals and institutions in South Africa, Siri, University of Stellenbosch, Professor Tulio de Oliveira, and their collaborators shared early sequence data on what we now call the Omicron variant. It's one of the things that we're trying to develop at the Rockefeller Foundation's Pandemic Prevention Institute is a collaborative network of trusted partners that share information as quickly as it's validated and ready for decision makers. This is why we have so much advance warning to prepare. Now, what are the questions that we need to answer? We need to understand how transmissible it is, and we need to understand if that transmissibility is coming because, like the Delta variant, it's just much better at infecting pretty much everybody, or is this an immune escape variant? And then, of course, the second question, is this more or less or the same with respect to virulence as the existing Delta variant and the variants before Delta?
And with this network that you're talking about, I mean, I know there's no magic answer to this, but how long does it take for us to know that? Will we have a decent feel for that in a week, in 2 weeks, tomorrow?
Well, as we've seen in South Africa, the case numbers are going up at an alarming rate. Now, this doesn't mean that we should panic. In fact, the case numbers were very, very low in South Africa just a few weeks ago, basically. It's one of the reasons why the early data are difficult to interpret. However, because the concern is that Omicron is spreading so fast, that actually means we'll know a lot sooner whether it really is something we need to be worried about on the transmissibility side. In terms of the effectiveness of the vaccines, in terms of the severity, that's something that's going to take, you know, more like a week or weeks before we'll have good estimates of those.
So as you think about modeling, what do we know now that this time last year we didn't know about the virus?
Interestingly, not very much. We knew this time last year that variants were likely to emerge. We knew this time last year that we were going to have vaccines that would be highly effective. We knew this time last year about the importance of masking, testing, border screening, good ventilation. We've just mostly not invested in those areas in the right ways and gotten out in front of the SARS-CoV-2 virus. A lot of us were having conversations this time last year that we need to layer in physical distancing, masking, testing, tracing with the vaccines to try to drive COVID numbers as low as possible. We need enhanced wastewater surveillance, genome surveillance to get ready for the emergence of variants. And really in the United States, we have focused so heavily and nearly exclusively on vaccines that we've not put in the infrastructure we need around testing, around tracing, to really be more prepared for variants like Omicron.
How much would it matter if we had much more wide, ubiquitous, low-cost testing to your ability to model and help us make progress?
Well, of course, our ability to model is going to be directly linked to how well the virus can be controlled, because the more we test, the more cases you identify. Individuals can get into isolation, receive care, people can go into quarantine, you control the spread. And so one of the key pieces is ubiquitous, low or no cost rapid testing in addition to PCR testing. Importantly, there are data out now suggesting that these tests will work just fine for the Omicron variant. So hugely important and an area where we still have not seen enough investment in the United States.
So Sam, in a word, yes or no, are you being more cautious than you were 2 or 3 weeks ago?
I am being more cautious, but that's because of the Delta variant, which is here and something that we need to take seriously.
Okay. And last words of wisdom, the big thing you're watching.
The big thing I'm watching is how quickly it will start to spread in places like the UK that have very good surveillance. And we're starting to see the first cases show up.
All right. That is Sam Scarpino, Managing Director of Pathogen Surveillance at the Rockefeller Foundation's Pandemic Prevention Institute, also an affiliate professor at Northeastern. Sam, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
It's time to ask the doctors, and we have Omicron on our minds. Scientists at the World Health Organization say the global risk from the new variant first seen in southern Africa is very high. And the CDC is now saying that all adults should, not can, but should get a booster due to Omicron. This, as we have said, with the 7-day average test positivity rate in the Commonwealth at almost 4%. It's worth noting that accurate numbers from Thanksgiving really won't be here for a few more days, so we're not sure where we're going to be. And meanwhile, chatter as Governor Baker told GBH yesterday that a QR code system to prove vaccination status could be on its way to the Commonwealth. Is that something you want? Well, where are you in this pandemic? Have you been boosted? Have you decided to have your child, age 5 to 11, vaccinated? Do you have questions about Omicron? We all have questions about Omicron. What do you need to know? It's on the table, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining us, Dr. Shira Derone, infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center, and Dr. Sabrina Asumu, assistant professor of medicine at Boston University School of Medicine, an infectious disease specialist at Boston Medical Center. Dr. Derone, welcome back.
Wonderful to be back.
And Dr. Asumu, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you for having me on.
So before the break, we were speaking with Sam Scarpino, who's an affiliated faculty member at Northeastern University, does modeling, talking about the Omicron variant and saying the big question is transmissibility in his mind and what the data is going to tell us about that. Is that the big question for you too, Dr. Derone? What are you watching when it comes to Omicron?
Yes, I think that, you know, there are three main questions, and transmissibility is the number one. And the other two are, does the variant evade immunity, immunity from vaccination, immunity from prior infection? And is it more virulent or more deadly, something we have not seen with another variant yet?
And Dr. Asumu, I am going to be a simpleton on this on purpose. When we say, does it evade immunity? We were talking today about our efficacy numbers around the vaccines. What does it mean to evade immunity? Does that mean you don't get it at all? Does it mean you don't get really sick? And how do we think about efficacy of a vaccine? What's that definition anymore?
Yeah, no, those are all really great questions. It's funny because we tend to use and throw these terms around, but it's really nice to just go back to the basics. So when we're talking about evading immunity, we're just trying to see if is it going to make the vaccines work not as well? So that's one thing. Another question would be, would the antibodies, like the monoclonal antibodies that we're using, when someone is infected, or to prevent, you know, someone from getting sick when they're at high risk, are those still going to work? And then the other question is, you know, the antivirals that are on the rise and the oral ones, are they still going to work? So pretty much what we're trying to figure out is it going to be possible for this variant to diminish the amount of protection that you get if you've developed immunity either through the vaccines or because after an infection?
And stay with me, Dr. Esumu. When you say the amount of protection that you get, again, protection from what? From getting sick at all? From getting really sick? From having symptoms?
Yeah, no, this is really great. It's interesting because I can see that you know, we've been talking about all these different levels of protection.
Right.
And I really love how, you know what? I really love how you're really pushing us here, right? So so first of all, one of the things that we've been talking about, even with, like, you know, the Delta variant, we kept saying, you know, the vaccines are still really good at protecting you for what we really care about, which is severe disease, hospitalization, and death. So that's definitely one level of protection that we will be thinking about. And in terms of that immunity, usually we think about T cell immunity that usually protects you from those particular outcomes that we just talked about. So, you know, even if the Omicron variant is able to cause, you know, minor and mild disease and people who are vaccinated and have responded well, it is still, in my book, a win if it doesn't cause severe disease or someone to be hospitalized or die. So we're still going to have to wait and figure out and get some answers. But I've been very impressed with these vaccines that we've had, and they've been really good at inducing T-cell immunity, which is what is going to really protect us from severe disease, hospitalization, and death.
So Dr. Durone, coming back to you for a minute, and then I'll go to the phones. We talked about transmissibility and the question mark around that with Omicron. I want to play a little sound for you. Governor Baker yesterday on GBH talking about booster capacity in the Commonwealth. Here he is.
When I go look at VaxFinder at mass.gov, I can always find appointments. Now, they may not be in the place somebody wants to go to get one, and it may be a week or 10 days out or 2 weeks out before they can get one. But given the fact that we have far more demand now than we had a couple weeks ago, we're going to see if we can increase our capacity to do more.
Okay, so speak to people's hearts, Dr. Durone. So here we're hearing about Omicron, CDC saying everybody go get boosted. The governor's saying, well, it might be hard to get to. It could be several days, a couple weeks. We're going to need to beef up our capacity. If one does not have a booster yet, that might be cold comfort. Should it be scary to be unboosted for, you know, let's say 3 weeks right now?
I want everybody who wants a booster to be able to get one right away. So, you know, it's disappointing to hear that people are trying to get boosters and they're not able to get access. But I'll tell you that that's the reality. So here at Tufts Medical Center, we were doing about 6,000 a week in the spring. In the summer, we were doing about 250 doses, of vaccine a week. And in the last week, we did over 3,500. So the demand has suddenly increased, whether it's because cases are rising, whether it's because of holidays, or whether it's now in the last few days due to Omicron. It is definitely suddenly in demand. I want people to get them. I want to remind people that two doses of vaccine are still very protective against severe disease, hospitalization, and death, but having a booster under your belt is better.
Let's go to the phones, 800-423-8255. I want to turn to Lori in Rhode Island. Lori, go ahead with your question.
Hello, can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can. Fire away, Lori.
Wonderful. I was vaccinated with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine back in March, and I couldn't wait to get a Pfizer booster or a Moderna booster, and I just did that 2 weeks ago. But I also saw a recent study of veterans saying that after about 8 months or so, the efficacy of the J&J vaccine reduces to about 13%. So what I'm wondering is, am I essentially unvaccinated now from the J&J vaccine, and do I need more than one booster shot?
Thanks for the question, Lori. And Lori, I don't know that study, so I don't know about those numbers, but we do know that the efficacy of the J&J vaccine did drop over time. That's why people as early as 2 months after the first dose were encouraged to get boosted. So Dr. Esumu, the answer to Lori's question.
No, this is a really great question. And I'm going to first start by reiterating what is the current recommendation for J&J so that we're clear and we're starting off at the same spot. So for J&J, the current recommendation is that you get a second shot 2 months after the original shot. And this is sort of to get you back to sort of an efficacy that is as good as what we had seen with the mRNAs. That is the current recommendation. The good thing about it also is that you could, the recommendation is that you can get either a second J&J or you can get an mRNA. Right now, it seems that if you do get the mRNA, is actually you may have a better response. So that is what we're recommending to people right now.
mRNA, excuse me, just for a second, mRNA being Pfizer or Moderna.
Yes, sorry. Yes.
That's okay.
mRNA meaning either Pfizer or Moderna. So that, you know, if I, you know, we often recommend, you know, look at your own risk factors to determine, but I would say, like, what am I recommending to my patients? I say, you know, if you had a J&J as your first shot, get an mRNA, either Pfizer or Moderna as the second shot. And we believe that once you do that, you're actually very well protected and you shouldn't have to worry. In terms of, you know, are we going to need additional shots for people who got J&J? Time will tell. But one thing I want to reassure you is that if you get that second shot, which is an mRNA shot, you're well protected.
And another thing that I like to underscore. So I'm sorry, I'm just going to stay there with Lori's original question for a second longer, Dr. Asumu. And a second mRNA dose is not necessary. You haven't basically become unvaccinated from J&J, in which case you would need two doses of mRNA. Do you understand the question?
Yes. So actually, this is actually the second point I wanted to make. One of the things that was really that was really great to see from the J&J vaccine was that with just one shot, the J&J vaccine was able to induce T cell immunity, a T cell response which you require usually two mRNA doses to induce. So meaning for you to get the T cell immunity, which is what is going to be more long lasting and what is going to prevent you from getting severe disease, hospitalization, and death, the J&J shot was actually able to do that in one shot. But what we did see with the J&J is that, you know, by giving a second shot, you can actually get a better response. And that's why that's what we were recommended. So I want to reassure her that if you have, you know, your J&J shot and then you get like an mRNA or a second shot of whatever shot you decide, you're very well protected with like the data that we have right now.
And following up just, Lori, to your call, the LA Times, November 4th, says that according to a study published in the Journal of Science, the protective power of Johnson & Johnson's single-dose vaccine plunged from 86% to just 13% over 6 months. So Lori's numbers that she called in with were there. So Dr. Durone, let's stay with this for a minute, because another question that we've been asked a lot, like in between Ask the Doctor shows, is when one gets a booster shot, how soon are you legit boosted? Is it the next day? Is it 2 weeks later, as with the waiting period with original vaccines? How should one think about that?
Well, neither with the original vaccines nor with the boosters does some switch flip on at 2 weeks at which you are good to go. The vaccines, whether it's the first, second, or third shot, they start working right away. They're revving up your immune system, and you can really see with each passing day, you can see more and more protection if you look at things like rates of infection in that time period. So, you know, different studies have used different definitions of, you know, fully vaccinated or fully boosted. So I don't think there's a hard and fast rule. You know, we know that fully vaccinated is 2 weeks after that last dose, but there is no sort of need to define that for societal purposes. For boosters, I would say by a week after that dose, you're pretty well covered.
800-423-8255 to ask your coronavirus question. And Dr. Asumu, I'm going to actually tiptoe out of the coronavirus world a little bit into a related world, which is the guidance from the state that if hospitals are at risk for patient capacity, they may need to reduce or eliminate some elective surgeries and procedures. Elective, at one point, we were talking about this in preparing for today, one might have assumed that that meant something truly optional, maybe plastic surgery or something cosmetic, for example. We're not just talking about that here. What does elective surgery mean, and what could be at risk if our hospitals are past capacity? And I want to note, a lot of this is, in fact, due to staffing shortages. And I think that's actually a really important qualifier here. Dr. Asumu.
Yeah, no, thank you for bringing up this issue. You know, this is why, you know, when at the beginning of the pandemic in 2020, we were all chanting, you know, flatten the curve, right? Because we wanted, what we were trying to do is we did not want to have hospitals be overwhelmed, because when we're overwhelmed, you know, outcomes are not as good. But also, you know, think about procedures that need to happen. You are 100% correct when you say that elective is not what we think of as elective, right? Elective could be someone who has, you know, a diagnosis that's unclear, you know, could it be cancer? Could it be something else? And someone needs to have a procedure to determine what the actual diagnosis is. It's not an emergency right now, but it needs to be done sooner rather than later. And so if the hospitals are overwhelmed and our emergency room are overwhelmed with, you know, with very sick patients with COVID-19, we're not able to do procedures like that. So it is very, very important. And I like that you're bringing up this point, that we remind the public that there are a lot of procedures that are very much necessary and that will unfortunately need to be postponed if our hospitals are overwhelmed.
Do you think that's going to happen, Dr. Asumu?
Well, I hope not. And I know that we're preparing for that, actually. But in terms of that was actually an issue before we started talking about Omicron, before it even came in the picture,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
With just Delta. And I think what I want to remind everyone is that we are still in the middle of trying to deal with Delta and the implications of just having Delta and overwhelming our healthcare facilities with the winter, the cold weather. So there is definitely a lot that we can all do to make a difference, and that is vaccination. And, you know, I'm here again to encourage people, if you haven't been vaccinated yet, please get your first shot. Please talk to your healthcare professional so that you can get your questions answered.
I remember the first time you were on, Dr. Asumu, saying to everyone who called, I'm so glad you're interested in getting vaccinated, or you're asking about getting vaccinated. Dr. Duron, so here we are now. We're at that vaccination conversation still. And we know there are people out there who are now saying, well, does this raise questions about the efficacy of vaccines overall? We're in a Delta surge. We're worried about Omicron. You know, CNN reporting earlier this hour, travel restrictions in more than 70 countries around the world. You and I have talked about public health messaging in the past. That can confuse and shake people's confidence in the importance of vaccines. Would you address that for just a moment, please?
Sure. It's a really difficult place to be. You know, I feel an acute sense of disappointment in the fact that we rolled out these unbelievable vaccines almost a year ago, and yet here we are with steeply rising case curves. And in parts of the country and parts of the world, we still are seeing the threat of overwhelmed healthcare systems from COVID-19. But let me clarify that the hospitals in Massachusetts are full. They're not full from COVID-19. They're full due to staffing and acuity of non-COVID illness with a more minor impact of COVID-19. You know, just to put it in perspective, you know, we're running about 15 patients with COVID in the hospital right now. Here we are, you know, at the height of the first wave, you know, we were talking more than 90 patients. And of the 15 that we have at any given time here in the hospital, a solid chunk of those are not here due to COVID-19. They get tested on admission and they have COVID-19, but they would be here anyway, even if they didn't. And certainly some of those are vaccinated. And about half of those who are vaccinated are not here due to complications of COVID-19.
Dr. Duron, I'm going to have to stop you there. I'm sorry. I appreciate the clarification. We are going to stop there. Dr. Shira Duron, infectious disease physician at Tufts Medical Center, and Dr. Sabrina Asumu of Boston Medical Center. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, a story that we here in Boston just cannot get enough of. Yeah. It's the Gardner heist. More than 30 years after the world's largest art heist, and we are still getting new information, a tantalizing clue, as one of our next guests described it. And so here to tell us about that clue, Boston Globe investigative reporter Shelley Murphy and former longtime Globe investigative reporter Steve Kirkshin. Shelley, welcome.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome to you too.
Welcome. Thank you. Nice to be here.
So, Steve, I'm going to start with you because we are reintroducing a real-life character here, and you're the perfect person to remind us briefly who he is. One of the main suspects, Bobby Donati. Remind us.
Yes, Robert Donati was a grew up in Boston, Everett, and fell into the criminal world and had an association with a crime boss named Vinnie Ferrara, who had a gang that was seeking to replace or take over from the Angiulo family, which owned the underworld back in the 70s and 80s. Ferrara wound up in jail 3 months before the Gardner Museum heist. And as I wrote in my book, Master Thieves, he got a visitor one day while he was in jail shortly before the heist, and it was Bobby Donati. Bobby knew Vinnie Ferrara and said, "We're going to pull off the theft that's going to get you out of jail." There had been a long-held suspicion in the underworld that trading precious art to the authorities would get your loved one or your associate out of jail or a better cell or whatever. It's a myth, but still, you can't tell criminals like Bobby Donati that it wouldn't work. Ferrara told him it wouldn't work, but my thought is that in today's story gives another clue towards that Donati went ahead and pulled off this theft of a lifetime.
So let's pick up there. And I do want to say we'll come back to you, Steve, because Donati did meet his demise, and we'll talk about that. But first, Shelley, you wrote about this tantalizing clue that Donati might have had been in possession of at least one of the 13 stolen pieces. Tell us.
Right. And just to give kudos here to Steve Kirchin, you know, he found this man who was a jeweler in downtown Boston, had a store in the jeweler's building, which was right across from the old Jordan Marsh, Macy's, and he appraised jewelry. And the way he tells it, in 1990, Bobby Donati walked into his store holding something, which was a gilded a bronze finial. It was very shiny, gold-like, and a finial like shaped like an eagle that sits on top of a flagpole. And he put this down on the desk and asked him what he thought it was worth. And Paul Calantropo said he immediately recognized that what it was, that this was one of the pieces stolen from the Gardner Museum just about a month earlier. It was swiped from the top of a Napoleonic flag. He recognized what it was and said, "Well, why didn't you just bring me the Mona Lisa? You know, I can't sell that. You can't, I mean, what do you mean? It's not worth anything. It's clearly stolen." And that Donati laughed, and Donati left with it. The reason this is so significant is, and to this day, we don't really know, you know, who were the two thieves that went into the Gardner Museum and stole Rembrandt and the Vermeer and artwork now valued at more than $500 million. The FBI has a pretty good theory. They think they know who did it. They say the two thieves who they think did it are dead, but they haven't publicly identified them. And really, until the artwork is recovered, this remains unsolved. There are just a lot of theories, maybe good theories, but theories. So why this is so significant is that you have this, you know, jeweler who said he recognized this and gave a description that was consistent, you know, with the finial that was stolen from the Gardner Museum. So as Steve just said, Bobby Donati's name has surfaced in this case, you know, as a potential suspect going back to like the late 90s. But this is really significant because over the years, there have been many, many theories, many suspects, you know, many reported sightings of some of the artwork all over the world, but very few that have been considered credible. And the FBI clearly found this credible enough that as recently as August, they searched a home that Bobby Donati's ex-wife and sister lived in. And this was based on information that was brought to them by Dean Kirchin, who's here with us.
So let me pick it up. Pick it up there, Shelley, because so this is the third time we're covering the Gardner heist this year. There was a documentary, and then there was the passing of Bobby Gentile earlier this year. this is exciting and new, and yet there have been big breaks before, Steve, and it feels like they never leaked anything. To Shelley's point, there was a raid or a search of a house in August, and nothing came up. Bobby Donati's been dead for decades. Briefly, Steve, do you believe this leads somewhere, or is it just a piece that we now know?
You know, as I put on Facebook, it's another window. Is it another door? I'd take our conversation into a different avenue, and that is to reach out to the public to try to convince the museum and even the FBI. They have worked valiantly and endlessly on this case and have come up with very little hard evidence. Nothing has been recovered. No one has been arrested. They have issued great requests to the public. I would try another approach, and that would be a social media campaign. And I would put in front, we've all been to the museum since the theft. We see how haunting those empty frames are in the second floor of the museum in the Dutch Gallery. I would have put in front of those paintings, I'd put up one of those empty frames, someone like Cardinal O'Malley, and have him issue an appeal to the public. Mrs. Hawley, the original director of the museum when the theft took place, she had reached out to the Pope. Vatican turned them aside on that request. But I think Cardinal O'Malley would be willing to do it. A social media campaign would work here because Boston has changed since the 1990 when this theft happened. It is a world-class city. We no longer have omerta, silence of the of never snitching being the operative principle here.
So,
and I think if you reach out to the public, those people who know bits and pieces of evidence would be persuaded, or might be persuaded, that it's time to give up the scraps of information. I think the artwork is hidden in places that several places. But it's inside the Boston area.
Shelley, I'm going to turn to you. Steve, thank you. And I'm sorry, I'm sort of running a little bit roughshod. We're on limited time, and I do want to get Shelley's voice back in one more time. Shelley, briefly, do you think there's enough information out there, knowledge, people left living, to put that picture, no pun intended, together? Just briefly, Shelley.
Well, I mean, there's a $10 million reward. It's hard to imagine that. I mean, if someone knows something, they should come forward. I mean, I do think that it's a good theory that they're hidden somewhere where people don't know, and that could be part of the problem. I mean, I'd be saying search your attics and your crawl spaces. You know, these guys are known for creating walls behind walls and under floorboards and in ceilings. And if somebody knows something, they should come forward. The statute of limitations has expired on any charges being brought against the thieves. But if you're found in possession of it, you can be charged. So if somebody really does know something, much better to come forward and try to cash in.
All right. That is Shelley Murphy and Steve Kirkjian. Shelley is an investigative reporter at The Globe. Steve is a former investigative reporter there and author of Master Thieves. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Finally, tonight, let's play a little game. What do all of these names have in common? Change My Mind, Exit 12, Distracted Boyfriend. And if the others don't ring a bell, how about Bernie Sanders and his mittens? As you have probably guessed by now, the answer is memes. We want to revisit a conversation about memes with local origins, with some people who know a lot about the subject right now, Amory Sievertson and Ben Brock Johnson, the co-hosts of WBUR podcast Endless Thread. This season, Endless Thread is talking about all things memes and what they tell us about ourselves, the world around us. We'll hear more from Amory and Ben in a few minutes, but first I want to play a piece of sound from the first episode of their season about the origins of the meme. Kilroy was here. I'm going to set this up for you. The first person you're going to hear is Phil Edwards of Vox. In this sound, he's recounting visiting the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. You'll then hear Ben and Amory in there, too.
It's very beautiful. But I'd heard that there was this secret thing hidden around the corner. And so I go, I'm looking for it, I don't see it.
The it here was not the memorial itself. Phil didn't feel much of a connection to that. It felt too abstract. But this secret treasure he was looking for, that is what drew him to this monument. And what moved him, once he found it.
And I finally peek around, and over a fence just beyond it, kind of hidden in the corner, is a little drawing. And it's of a man peeking over a wall. His giant nose is kind of hanging over it. And under it, it says, "Kilroy was here."
Kilroy was here, hiding in plain sight on the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., a little image with text staring back at him.
The eyes are basically usually two dots. In some cases, they're drawn differently. But two dots, and then it's just a line drawing.
The line drawing is extremely spare. It's this little bald head with beady eyes and a big droopy nose and two sets of little fingers, all peering over a horizontal line that looks like a wall. Even though it's meant to feel like a secret, it's not. The image and text is literally carved into the stone of this memorial.
This was part of the design of the monument from the beginning, and I was really interested in how something so ephemeral as this graffiti could make it onto a monument and actually endure to be like a part of World War II history.
This graffiti was part of World War II history because during the war, this little doodle wasn't just here.
I mean, he ends up everywhere.
Everywhere as in all over the globe. And yet, for a long time, nobody knew why, where it came from. It was just this recurring, mysterious piece of graffiti. Sometimes the text changed, there were different versions of the image, but the basic building blocks were always recognizable.
You just heard an excerpt from episode 1 of the current season from WBUR's Endless Thread. We recently caught up with Ben Brock Johnson and Amory Sievertson, co-hosts of Endless Thread, about Kilroy Was Here. I started by asking them about their favorite memes.
I always stand by the Willy Wonka when he has his head rested in his hand and, you know, he's making that expression that's like, "Oh, yes, do. Please tell me how hard your life is." That sort of a thing.
And Ben, how about you?
Recently, I've gone back to one that everybody knows, I feel, or at least that's what it feels like when you know a meme, is that everyone else knows the exact same meme, but then quickly you discover that people don't know what you're talking about sometimes when you're describing them. But the one I'm thinking of right now is the dog sitting inside of the cavern that is on fire, and the dog is saying, "This is fine."
So let's back up. And I will say, I think if I had to answer the question, it's a pre-internet meme. It is the fact that in the 80s, I saw Andre the Giant's face spray painted everywhere.
Oh, yeah. Great one. Obey.
Yes. Obey. Exactly. So that's the one I think that sticks most for me. So let's back up, because we've just talked about a bunch of them, some from the internet era, some not. Your first episode is about a pre-internet meme. So what is a meme, Amory?
A meme, it's easiest to think of it like a gene, but for cultural information. So it's a unit of cultural information that passes from person to person or society to society, civilization to civilization. And as it passes, it changes. So whether that's the text or the caption changing on an image, or maybe it's a caption that remains the same, like "Nature is healing," and it's the image that changes. It's a different relevant piece of information that represents "Nature is healing." So it is just like this little unit of culture that passes and morphs a little bit as it passes.
And that morphing and passing, Ben, is part of what makes a meme like viral and successful versus something that just kind of dies on the vine.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that over time, if a meme is successful, it creates an in-group, right? And sometimes that means it also creates an out-group. But the people who really resonate with the meme, it's in its original form, or at least the form that it's reaching them at, they then take it and remix it, evolve it, put their own spin on it, and continue to amplify it out in the world. And it's really fun to watch them spread, and also interesting and sometimes scary.
So we, I think, in Boston, love to pride ourselves on being the origin of many important things, some might say most important things. And you guys start with this meme that predates meme, right? With Kilroy
yep.
Was here. And it turns out deep inner local origins and maybe one of the first. So talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So there's a lot of arguments about what the first meme is.
This one, Kilroy Was Here, is a lot of people agree that this one is really the first meme, or by some measures the first meme. But there are also memes that are even older than this one. This one started just before World War II, as near as we can tell, although it has some older origins as well. But even like in the Middle Ages, monks drawing snails in manuscripts, there are earlier and earlier examples of memes. But Kilroy Was Here, it reminds me of Ziggy.
Yeah.
Like that cartoon, if that makes sense. Like this kind of like simple line drawing with a sort of bulbous nose peeking over a wall. And it started, as near as we can tell, it started right here in Boston.
So take us there, Amory, without giving too much away, but take us there a little bit on how it did start.
Yeah, well, as a resident of Quincy myself, I have to say, it started in Quincy, Ben. Not
Oh, my bad,
Quincy
my bad.
People
at least I didn't say Cambridge, right? At least yeah, okay. Yeah,
there was a shipyard in Quincy where a lot of major vessels were made that were sent out into World War II. And there was a ship inspector there who worked in the shipyard named James J. Kilroy. And his job was basically to inspect the rivets of the ship that were, you know, literally holding the ship together. And as he's going around and inspecting these rivets, you're supposed to kind of sign your name or at least take stock of what rivets have been checked. And the riveters are getting credit for every rivet they put in that ship.
They get paid by the rivet.
Literally paid by the rivet. And so you want the inspector to think that you have installed as many rivets as possible. So James J. Kilroy, the inspector, was literally signing his name in yellow grease crayon. Kilroy Was Here, so that he would know, I already inspected this part of the ship. You guys aren't going to fool me in thinking that you have put more rivets than you've actually put in this part of the ship.
Basically to keep from double counting.
To keep from double counting. Right. And the word is that these ships sometimes were moving out of the shipyard so quickly. They were being made so quickly that normally what would have been painted over Kilroy Was Here in the underbelly of the boat, they didn't even have time to paint over it. So some of these ships were going out into battle still with that yellow grease crayon marking Kilroy Was Here there, which means that this message, which really only meant something to the people making the ships, was then going out into battle and going around the world for the Allied forces in this case to see. And kind of it became almost like a comforting symbol that, you know, an American crew made this ship that's going out into battle.
There's another interesting aspect to it, which I learned in producing this episode, which is some of the people who were building the ships ended up serving, and they would literally build the ship and then get on it and go overseas and serve. Those people end up spreading the meme that way as well. And like Amory said, it starts out as this kind of surveillance tool for an inspector, but it ends up being this thing that people recognize as a sign of friendliness, a sign that someone like them, someone on their side, had passed through. And that we thought was a really powerful and interesting aspect to the meme as well.
So it actually kind of haunted me, because as I listened to you tell the story, the idea that somebody would so desperately feel alone and lost that they would need to find that common bond, that meaning in this bulbous nose peering over the edge of a wall in these three words, Kilroy Was Here, was actually deeply haunting, I thought.
Yeah.
It's interesting to hear you say that. I haven't thought of it so much as haunting, because I've really clung to what was described to us as a comforting aspect, and maybe as a sign of force, right? My brain was kind of broken open while working on this series when someone suggested to me that even the American flag itself has become a kind of meme, because it means, you know, you could say, no, hands down, it means American, you know, patriotism, but it doesn't mean that to everyone else. You know, we all react to symbols differently. And so Kilroy Was Here for some people might have been a sign of strength. Rumor had it that it had been written in, what was it, Ben, like a Joseph Stalin's bathroom stall, or that Joseph Stalin saw it in a bathroom stall.
Yes.
And it was meant to be this kind of intimidating, you know, pro-American or pro-Allied forces message, but also to some other people, a sign of comfort, you know, have heart, that there are other people out here who have your back, and we're, you know, we're in this together, and stay strong, even though you're thousands and thousands of miles away from home.
Where it was drawn around the world, sometimes it lasted longer than the GI's lives, right, who were drawing this thing. And I found that aspect of it absolutely haunting. But memes, I think, so often serve as this kind of unofficial yet very relatable form of communication among regular people, you know, quote unquote, where you can put a feeling or an idea out into the world and it really resonates with tons of people all over the place. And it's not necessarily propaganda. It's not official messaging, but it's actually this thing that people really respond to. And I think, honestly, like the "this is fine, everything is on fire" meme that we were referencing earlier is another example of that. Like, people have felt during COVID, right? Like this thing that, like, it can denote sadness or frustration or dismay or despair just as much as it can, you know, denote a joke or something funny.
So, Amory, let's pick up on Ben's point about the timelessness, or at least the fact that the meme outlived some of the people to whom it was important, and maybe even who etched it somewhere or drew it somewhere. It's still present today. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, you know, I don't know how often it is still being written, but there's definitely, it lives on in a way that there is a forum on Reddit. There's a subreddit. There's a website that's maintained by, I think, someone with connections to the Quincy Shipyard, where people are still logging sightings of Kilroy Was Here. And I actually, I went for a hike in the Quincy Quarries the other weekend, and I saw a Kilroy Was Here graffitied onto a rock there.
Wow.
Right. So there's a little magic in it, in that you don't know who put it there. You don't know why they put it there. You don't know where they first saw it. You don't know if they know the story behind it. But it does have this energy behind it, this kind of timelessness, that someone saw it somewhere and wanted to keep it going for who knows what reason. But someone else is going to see that on that rock in Quincy Quarries, and then maybe they're going to write it somewhere else. And maybe they're assigning a completely different meaning to it.
It's also in a Seinfeld episode and an Outkast song, and it's like it gets referenced in a lot of pop culture as well. There's a horror movie that came out, I think, a couple of years ago that was titled Kilroy Was Here. So it survives through pop culture as well, which I think is interesting.
Ben Brock Johnson and Amory Sievertson, co-hosts of WBUR's podcast Endless Thread, speaking with us recently about the meme Kilroy Was Here. You can listen to full episodes of Endless Thread on WBUR.org or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And tune in tomorrow night, because we'll explore another meme with local origins. Maybe you've seen it online. It's called Scumbag Steve. That's tomorrow night here on Radio Boston. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Walter Wuthman, Amanda Beland, and Cynthia Betubiza. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.